Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. We are officially past Thanksgiving. Is that right?
We survived.
Past Black Friday?
Yes.
So I can now say, happy holidays. We're allowed.
Yeah.
Happy holidays.
You can say that whenever you want, Randy.
No, if you say it before Thanksgiving, people will beat you.
Really?
Yeah.
Halloween is a holiday.
Yeah, that's true. Halloween is a holiday, but I believe it is, it's sort of a different holiday. You're allowed to mention that whenever. Halloween could be year-round. Like, yeah. Most people I know would be okay with it. But it does seem like, holidays, people do not want to hear about the holidays until after Thanksgiving.
It's true.
There's a feeling that Christmas is encroaching.
Yeah.
And nobody wants that.
And, you know, I am fond of the hold off until after you eat the turkey.
Yep.
Before and you go full Christmas.
Exactly.
Do any of you have Christmas trees already up?
No, because I had a game day this weekend, and we didn't want to deal with it being in the way, but now it'll probably go up this week.
Yeah.
Our stores, Christmas exploded all over our store.
Yep. We had some former staffers and friends show up. Vinny Carter and Roxy McDaniel came out and did some awesome decorating for us. Randy put up some decorations.
I did.
And I put up some decorations.
Yeah.
And we played Christmas music.
Yep.
And it was very fun. Oh, and in fact, I need to post to the store's Facebook page. I never got around to it. Vinny made us that awesome Batman wreath.
You posted it on your personal. People love that wreath. It is badass.
It is great. It's we'll post it on the Facebook, so it'll probably be up by the time y'all hear this. But it is, in fact, in the shape of the Batman emblem, a wreath. It's really cool.
It's great. which brings us to holiday hours.
Yep.
We should let people know, on Saturday, December 10th, we will be closing at 7 p.m. early for our holiday party.
Yep.
So that all our staffers can get to that. On Friday, December 24th, no, Saturday, December 24th is Christmas Eve.
Right, so we'll close a little early.
So we'll close at 7 p.m., and, of course, the next Saturday, December 31st, is New Year's Eve. We'll close at 7 p.m. And then
that we'll actually be closed for Christmas?
I was getting to it.
You jumped ahead to New Year's?
I was going to hit everything that's at the same time. So 7 p.m. closing, early closing on the 10th, the 24th, the 31st. And we are fully closed on the Sundays of 25th and the 1st for New Year's Day and Christmas Day.
Yeah, we're going to take naps.
This is it's always our tradition, but the days shift because that's how our calendar works.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the deal. Do not book your very important comic book shopping for January 1st as we will be closed.
Yes. But we will see you that night before as you get games and stuff to celebrate with.
Indeed. All right. The other big holiday that came out this week was Star Wars Rogue One Ticket Day.
Right. Which is a little bit more of a difficult holiday.
Yeah, that was crazy.
You had to work for this one.
I got online and they had a queue. The Alamo had a queue of online queue that was like 4,000 people ahead of me.
Yeah.
Maybe 6,000.
Is that for all of the Austin draft houses?
I think so. I don't know if it was all the Alamos or whatever.
Or whether it was like nationwide.
But everybody trying to get into the ticket server was put in this online queue, which, by the way, I got to say, very good system. It worked out really well. Even though the shows we were hoping to get to sold out before we got to them. So we did have to wind up going to like a late midnight show instead of a 10 o'clock, which was our preference. And not all the staffers get to go now. But, Nick, I think you got your tickets for the day after, right?
I got them for that day.
Oh, you got them for that day.
I get to see it before you guys.
That's right.
I would rather see it
you found
you
some kind of loophole.
I must have because I – at what was it? I guess it was midnight or was it
– Well, I was – the 10 o'clock show was gone and the 10:30 show had like two seats in it randomly.
And I looked on my app and I was like, okay, I'll look at all the shows.
Oh, you were on the app?
I went to like – to the 7 o'clock show, and I was like, "Okay, there's one seat in there, but it's not. I need two." I went to the 7:30; there were no seats. Yep. I was like, "Get out!" And I was like, 8:30. Let's see if randomly two seats, like great seats.
Oh, it still wouldn't help me because I was looking for like eight seats.
Yeah. I wonder if Nick, if like you happen to look right as somebody like gave up their seats or
something possible.
Like that.
And if that happened, thank you. kind gentlemen or ladies, whoever gave up those seats, because I appreciate it.
I will say, I found this out, and I wish I'd found out ahead of time, the app did not have a queue. You could go right in and skip the line. So Nick skipped the line. That was his loophole. He cut in front of me.
Skipped the line at like midnight.
He's like he did the VIP thing.
Yeah, he did. He got past the velvet rope.
I went to the theater last time to get our tickets.
You did, and that's what I've learned is that for at least the next Star Wars movies, I don't know when this is going to start happening with Marvel movies, but probably need to go theater and stand in line.
Civil War. I mean, we didn't get tickets for the.
Yeah, we did.
Did we?
Yeah, we did.
Did we?
We just had to get close up.
Right.
But we got tickets. But yeah, it is. It's getting to be sort of old school standing in line, which I kind of appreciate as an old school guy. Yep. Anyway, very much looking forward to Rogue One. That's in a couple weeks. We will give you our spoiler review of it that next week.
And we're talking about the most exciting thing about Rogue One for me is the fact that it may introduce the word rogue to a broader audience outside of the geek community.
Downside, though, Dave, is that means telemarketers will now give themselves away less easily.
Yeah.
They'll be like, is this Rouge's Gallery?
Or Ragus Gallery.
Ragus Gallery, yeah.
We get it all.
People are going to know the word rogue. Although, it was already Rogue Squadron, and they didn't know that, so... all right. News this week. So, we got some casting news for Star Trek Discovery that Michelle Yeoh is going to be in it, but she is going to be a character named Han Bo, who is captain of a ship called the Shenzhou. So, she is not the captain of the ship.
Are we sure the Shenzhou is not this main ship?
Yeah, the ship's the Discovery.
Oh, dur, yeah. So that's interesting. Does that mean that there will be a... She'll be a recurring... It'll be some sort of recurring ship? That's just kind of unusual.
I would think so, yeah.
Except for, like, static locations like DS9, they don't tend to have a lot of... I mean, they sometimes have recurring villains like Q or whatever. Yeah. But you don't usually have other ships that are just kind of around a lot.
Yeah, I think that'll be interesting.
I'll be curious to see. Maybe they have some sort of... the equivalent of a partnered cop ship, you know, for wherever they are. I'm not even quite sure what their mission per se is.
Now, we have to do a whole bunch of speculating because we don't know much.
Yep. So I'm going to assume it's a buddy cop thing.
Uh-huh.
And that they're patrolling the neutral zone, and the captain of the Enterprise is 2 weeks from retirement.
I was thinking the Shenzhou is like 2 weeks from retirement.
Shenzhou is 2 weeks from retirement, yes. Michelle Yeoh will die at the end of the first episode, killed by a Klingon drug cartel. I have no idea. Who are the other casting people I didn't know as well? Is there everybody?
I don't think we know anything.
There's been two more.
Oh, have there? Okay.
Been added. That's Doug Jones.
Oh.
From Hellboy.
Presumably playing some kind of alien.
Yes, he is going to be they say a science officer and a new alien species.
Okay.
And then Anthony Rapp, who was in, like, A Beautiful Mind.
Okay.
He is, I don't know what he is going to be playing. Oh, an astro... I can't say... Fungus expert, basically. played by Rapp. Yeah.
Lieutenant fungus Stamets. Expert.
Stamets. An astro... Dave, say that word.
What are you looking at? It looks like astromycologist.
Astromycologist.
And since myconids are the fungus men in D&D, I assume that is weird. I don't know why you would have such a specific expert. Usually they have broad experts. So
that
you'd
is
have a,
weird and specific.
Yeah.
Does this mean that...
And they say they're all aboard the Shenzhou. Are we sure the Discovery is actually the name of the ship?
Oh, maybe it's not. Maybe the Shenzhou is the ship.
I could Shenzhou have
sworn I
ship.
Heard that was the name of the... ship too.
Me too.
But
who knows,
maybe it gets rechristened, maybe anything.
Maybe so. Or Dave, possibly it is not a Klingon drug cartel but a Klingon illegal mushroom space illegal. Mushroom cartel.
That's right,
and that's why they need a space mic on a shot and all about.
That's, that seems as likely as anything.
Yeah All right. CW put out a little teaser for Riverdale, their sort of mid-season Archie-like...
We don't know quite what it is. Check it out. It's just a little 30-second thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a little bit of, sexy teen young adult drama CW look to it.
More than a little bit.
Yeah, you're right. There was, people he's taken off his shirt and he's got ripped abs and all that.
Well, I mean, it's taking a lot from, Vampire Diaries. It makes sense. It's, one of the producers of...
I've never seen Vampire Diaries.
It's very much that.
It seems like they have a problem with shirts in Riverdale. It seems like
they burst open.
Yeah.
It's itchy.
But, and there's also a bag of money.
Right. Well, that was the thing. There was, hints of intrigue and, maybe even crime stuff going on, which led me to think that it had a little bit of a Veronica Mars vibe. Am I right, Randy, that Roberto Acuña Sacasa is producing?
Yeah, I believe so. He might even be involved in the writing.
Right, and that's the guy, for those who don't know, who's been, publisher? Or is
became
he,
their...
He's their publisher,
Their
right?
publisher or their executive... Oh, their chief creative, CEO, whatever. Yeah, whatever, editor-in-chief, whatever.
For the Archie books, yeah. And that's why, you know, so that's why they've had all the revamps recently, and the Afterlife with Archie.
He's also the writer on Afterlife with Archie and, Sabrina.
Yep. I will be curious to, you know, the trailer did not make me think, oh, that looks surprisingly good.
No.
It did, are they still in high school?
Yeah, I think they're
going to be skeevy to have them that sexed up?
No, that's kind of what they do now.
Do they?
Yeah,
they
Gossip Girl and all that kind of stuff. Yeah,
okay. America's going to weird places.
Yeah, you could say that again. but that's another story.
Yeah.
I think the thing that interests me most is that it's on CW, and the CW has been on a pretty bit of a hot streak for me. Even stuff like I love
iZombie,
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and I've heard Jane the Virgin's really good. And
No Tomorrow
you've liked?
I've only seen the first two or three episodes, but it's a really solid show.
And their sort of crime procedural version of Frequency looks kind of good, so... Mm-hmm. CW seems to be a pretty strong little mini network, so I'm curious to see what they do here, even though this teaser did not make me think, oh, good, sexy Archie, I can't wait.
However, this is a good kind of doorway to get people in, though, the people who liked Vampire Diaries and all that, and then they'll be like, oh, there's more to it than this.
Yeah. I noticed that the color palette was kind of grayed out.
Yeah.
Not like in a, this looks like a Batman movie or something that way, but it was muted. It wasn't like, you think of Archie, and even if it was like sort of a more serious version, you would think it'd be kind of a little
what
pop.
They haven't said is they're going to do Afterlife with Archie.
That'd be amazing. If the end of the first episode, zombies show up.
Yeah.
It'd be amazing.
I don't see that happening.
No, me neither, but it'd be so good if they managed to keep that under wraps and that was the thing.
What else we got?
All right. So this one, I feel like we must have talked about this movie, but I don't remember it. There's a movie coming from Sony called Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman.
Okay.
Do you know about this?
Nope.
It's coming out next year. And it is about the real-life creator of Wonder Woman, William Moulton Marston, mm-hmm. played by Luke Evans, who I don't know who that is. And he's in his relationship with his fellow psychologist and inventor, Elizabeth, played by Rebecca Hall, and their polyamorous relationship with Olive Byrne, played by Bella Heathcote. I know none of these names, by the way.
Okay. This is a major release?
It's a former student of Marston's. So this is a major release. It's Sony.
Okay.
I mean, he's the guy who invented the lie detector test, but it's interesting. It's going to be about their polyamorous relationship and the creation of Wonder Woman, although the movie is called Professor Marston and the Wonder Women.
Right. Luke Evans was the lead in Dracula Untold. He was in Girl on the Train, Fast and Furious 6. He was one of the villains.
Okay.
He's been around. I guess he's playing Gaston or Beast in the new Beauty and the Beast.
Okay.
He was one of the in Hobbit. The population of Smaug.
This crossed my...
He
was Smaug. He was the desolation.
He was the desolation.
But yeah, you know, I think we talked about, you know, William Marston. Is that the guy?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, notably sort of very hyper-progressive sexual and relationship values. Like, he was a kinkster dude. Mm-hmm. But I also created the lie detector or the concept that underlied it.
Yeah.
So, introduced pretty much the most famous female character in all of comicdom. So it will be interesting to see, what a movie about his life sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, the next 4 years should be a great time for feminism and kink. So, we should be seeing, I'm sure they'll find a very receptive audience in the heartland.
Actually, I think, what were we going to see, Randy? Big puritanical movies?
Yeah. We'll finally get that the Scarlet Letter remake.
It'll be a Scarlet Letter that really sides with the people who put the letter on her. Like that Roger Chillingsworth. What a guy.
Rebecca Hall played Maya Hansen in Iron Man 3.
That's where I know that name. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and a couple of others. And Bella Heathcote.
Heathcote. Yeah. She's in Twilight, right? Bella Heathcote, I think.
Team
Heathcote.
She was in that weird Johnny Depp Dark Shadows remake, okay, Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies.
Okay.
She was in Man in the High Castle.
Huh. Okay.
She made her name. So.
This crossed my path because they just cast Connie Britton and Oliver Platt in unnamed roles, presumably smaller roles because they're not any of the three majors, but thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Also, in the comic book news, there was a little teaser. It's like 1 minute. It's just a little action scene from Justice League Action, the new Cartoon Network series.
Somewhat in the tradition of The Brave and the Bold, it looks like.
A little bit more, yeah. And it's just a scene of Superman taking on their parasite, and Wonder Woman shows up. And
tonally, it looked Brave and the Boldish.
Yeah.
Parasite was kind of interestingly weird. He was like... almost more like, I don't want to say John Carpenter's The Thing, because it wasn't that gross,
but he
did have tentacles that popped out of his tum-tum. And he's also, like, hopping around, like clinging to the ceiling, almost like insect-like.
Well, because he's draining cockroaches, and it feels like that he took on some of the aspects
Do you think he actually physically morphed?
I think he might have.
Oh, okay. That'd be kind of cool. So, no, whatever he touches, he kind of gets a little bit of the visual similarity.
Because he had a little bit of the spiky design. I hadn't thought about it until right now, but yeah, I think that might have been that he took on the...
Yeah, I was thinking at first that he was just, like, whenever he mutated from a human into the parasite, he became that weird-looking thing. But, yeah, you're
probably
right.
That's possible, but it may be cockroachy.
Yeah. But anyway, it looked fun. I think it'll be something that easily people will be able to watch with their kids.
Yeah.
And it's going to teach a whole new generation of kids the most obscure of DC superheroes, just this like Brave and the Bold did.
Do we know anybody who's behind this? Is it anybody notable?
I don't have anything in front of me.
Okay. I didn't know if it was somebody like the people who did Batman Brave and the Bold or...
Well, Sam Register from Teen Titans Go, which I know a lot of people don't like, serves as executive producer.
Okay.
However, Butch Lukic, Alan Burnett, and Jim Krieg, who are from, respectively, Justice League, Batman Beyond, Batman the Animated Series, and Green Lantern the Animated Series, are all on board as producers.
Well, I think that's a pretty good pedigree.
It's a pretty good pedigree. The thing that worries me is Teen Titans Go.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing that I hear.
I thought people liked
No.
People like Teen Titans.
No, they like Teen Titans Go, too. They just feel like it sort of bastardizes the old one. But anybody I know who's actually watched it and kind of taken it for what it is, which is a much more humorous show, seems to really like it.
See, that's what I'm worried about. I don't want this to be... Teen Titans Go is shorts.
Right.
Like little 8-minute shorts, and they're all jokey.
I presume that that's the only thing these people can do.
No, but that's my worry. That's what I don't want them to do.
Yeah.
However...
Yeah, I don't think that's the...
I mean, they could do it vignette style, for all I know. I haven't seen enough to know.
I don't think they'll do a Justice League vignette show. I feel like that's kind of the wrong way to go with that.
Well,
property.
They're kicking off with Shazam Slam, a 4-part special event debuting Friday, December 16th at 6 p.m. Eastern. So if they're doing a 4-parter... That leads me to believe that it is not.
Yes. Yeah.
That's kind of weird, actually, that they would do that. That's longer than, like, the Justice League. They were mostly doing 3-parters when that was the serious...
I think, like, the Thanagar one did, like,
Dini and Tim. But, yeah, for the most part, they were...
Guys, 4 parts may mean 4 8-minute shorts.
That could be.
I would guess that is what it is.
Which could be mean the equivalent of, like... Or, it could be, like, 2 episodes worth, a big 2-parter... You know, that's split into 4 parts or something.
So I think that's my issue. Is this looks to me more like what Teen Titans Go is, which is what DC Nation was.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing a lot of shorts.
Yeah.
And some of those are really good, but they're not going to hold up to, say, Justice League Unlimited, that kind of thing. However, we've already had Justice League Unlimited.
Right.
And in the same way that a lot of us looked at Batman Brave and the Bold and were like, oh, Batman the Animated Series, why would they bother doing anything else? Because Batman the Animated Series was perfect. Then Brave and the Bold was great in its own way.
Right.
I'm hoping Justice League Action can do the same thing. In Shazam Slam, the villainous Black Adam battles Batman on the Rock of Eternity and unleashes a horde of djinn determined to turn the Earth back to its pre-human volcanic state.
Horde of what?
Djinn.
Oh, yeah, like genies?
Yes.
Like...
Affected by the otherworldly powers of these primordial monsters, Batman becomes possessed and is turned into a giant flying bat monster, laying waste to the Hall of Justice, with only Superman capable of taking the fight to the Dark Knight. One by one, the Justice League, with the help of Shazam, voiced by Sean Astin, by the way, and the Wizard, voiced by Carl Reiner, must hunt down and destroy each djinn in order to yet again save the world from destruction. That's how it starts. And then on Saturday, December 24th, it will begin its Saturday morning run.
Okay. Well, they're definitely doing some kind of fun celebrity voices.
And those are great.
Carl Reiner.
I think Sean Astin's perfect for Captain Marvel or Shazam or whatever you want to call it.
By the way, I'm reading this on a Comics Alliance site.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to ding Comics Alliance for something here, which is their writer who wrote this little piece, L. Collins, or Ellie possibly. She mostly just takes the official word, which I read. But up top, she's got her analysis of it. And it's like, Sean Astin voiced Shazam, by which I assume they mean the original Captain Marvel, since Astin is much better suited for a hero with the spirit of a child than for a wise old wizard. In fact, Carl Reiner is credited as the wizard, which probably means the character we used to call Shazam, since the old Justice Society villain the wizard would be a stranger choice. People. You need to get over it. His name is Shazam now.
Yeah.
Captain Marvel is Carol. Yeah. And not Mar-Vell. You need to get over it and move into the real world with the rest of us.
Randy, in my heart, he will always be Captain Marvel.
By the way, I know there's at least one listener who just flung his iPad across the phone of the room about
it. It is super stupid. There haven't been any good Shazam stories since he became Shazam. Not a one.
That's true.
It's like if you're writing about it, it's probably time to get over it.
Yeah.
You can't call him Captain Marvel. You can't call the guy the name of the biggest competitor. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It'd be like if Captain America was American DC or something. You change that name. I'm sorry. You have to bow to reality a little bit.
Yeah. And to be fair, 90% of people were calling him Shazam because they were dumbasses over the last 6 or 7
Because he was
decades.
Shazam in the 70s TV show, too.
Was it?
Well, it was called Shazam, wasn't it?
That was Power the Shazam and Isis Power Hour.
See? Shazam. Nowhere, Captain Marvel's not mentioned anywhere in that.
Right, but that was the legal stuff.
Sure, I know. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
It's been a while. Time to get over it, people. Uh-huh. Shazam, get on board.
So you've made a powerful stance, Randy.
Yes. However, the other thing I want to mention is that the other voices returning for this, Kevin Conroy is going to be voicing Batman, Mark Hamill will be the Joker, Diedrich Bader will be Booster Gold, which is fantastic, and James Woods is Lex Luthor.
Those are fantastic.
Yeah. Huh.
James Woods kind of actually is Lex Luthor. So
yeah, I was going to say that. All right, that is all the news we've got, so we will take a second and we'll be back with comics for the week. We're talking comics the week of Wednesday, November 30th. And Nick, why don't you kick us off?
All right. I'm going to be talking about some Inhumans and X-Men.
Yep.
Because Inhumans versus X-Men number 0 has hit this week. New series. I guess it's they're one of their big events, like 6 issues, double turn to 8 issues.
Yeah. Well, is it that big, though? I was not under the impression it is that civil. It's not Civil War.
Yeah, I thought this was more of a like Death of X mini event kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
Four issues. And sure. Bendis isn't writing it, so it probably won't expand beyond.
No,
it won't run super late.
It was a bad joke.
But it was just a shot at Civil War II.
Yes.
Which I appreciate.
But this is written by Charles Soule, art by Kenneth Rocafort. And this sort of tells the story of basically how the Inhumans and the X-Men are coming to war, essentially. It incorporates some
of the... been in, like, the equivalent of a Cold War while Terrigen Mist sweeps across the Earth?
The big thing is Beast is sort of their stopgap. He's the one that's working with the Inhumans to sort of trying to find the cure for the Terrigen Mist that are sort of ravaging around the world.
Can I... Real quick, temperature of the room. What do you guys feel about the Inhumans X-Men sort of Cold War thing going on as a concept?
Not excited about. But, like...
I think it's an interesting idea.
I felt like it could have been interesting. I guess I haven't read much of it.
Yeah, that's kind of...
I can't fairly judge it, but I feel like it hasn't been as interesting as I want it to be.
But just as a concept, I like the idea
it's
of
okay.
It. I like the notion... If they're going to do this thing where they modify the Inhumans, I like the idea of the mutants and the Inhumans and sort of... being similar but different enough that, you know, mutants is a sort of a culture within the human race. Inhumans has its own culture. Mm-hmm. Sort of like there's some interesting stuff to be done there.
Right.
Dave, I haven't been drawn to it, but
you know how Grant Morrison kind of moved if you take X-Men as race relations, he kind of moved it forward to the point where, you know, like the X-Men had been, you know, become a hip thing, but also probably you got the vibe that it might have been co-opted by privileged types. And
sure.
Somebody who'd never known a struggle in their life might be wearing a Magneto was right shirt just because it was cool.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's a cool new way to think about it that, you know, allows you to still deal with sort of oppression, but also get into, you know, the more nuanced issues with race today, or as it's going back, getting to back to straight up racism again.
But is it possible? Should humans not wear Wolverine claws? Is that appropriation?
Yes. And you could do something like that with mutants and humans, where you've got this like, hey, you know, you guys are both struggling, and you know, and you're tearing each other apart.
Yeah,
those would be interesting themes. They're, you know, questions of sort of, you know, like sort of sovereignty over areas are kind of interesting.
Right.
So, yeah, the more I think about it, the more I think it's an interesting idea. I don't know what they're doing with it.
Me neither. So, Nick, what are they doing with it?
The whole thing that Charles Soule is doing here is that it's sort of wheels within wheels. Beast is working with one of their new Inhumans, Zhaoyu Chen, which apparently is, like, super smart and kind of able to be on Beast's playing field level.
Right, he's on his intellectual level?
Yeah, or she, actually.
Or she, okay.
And then that it also tells of what White Queen is doing, sort of after the death of Cyclops.
Right.
Sort of the machinations that she's doing, because she doesn't see a way that this doesn't come to war.
Now, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Well, the Black Bolt unleashed the Terrigen Mist at the end of
Inhumanity number zero.
Inhumanity, yeah. Or whatever. And I don't know quite why he did that, but he did it.
He just thought it'd be funny.
No, it was to save the Inhuman race.
Okay. But like,
and that's sort of,
I presume that like that is just like a, at this point it became sort of like a natural disaster, basically for the mutants, poison gas is flowing across the world. But like, I assume not every Inhuman is like, oh, I'm so happy this poison gas is flowing across the world. Like, why would the mutants actually be angry? Shouldn't they be only angry at Black Bolt?
Well, they're angry at sort of all Inhumans because they see them as killing them.
I mean, that does seem a little weird to me. That's like being mad at a country because you don't like its leader.
But, you know, Black Bolt is sort of, so you have to be mad at Medusa, and you have to be mad at, and, you know, everyone follows Medusa, and therefore...
I would just say that, like, normally superheroes are a little more nuanced, where I would think, like, say...
Well, and there is more nuance here, because White Queen is definitely doing her own thing.
Sure.
Medusa's working with Beast. Uh-huh. I mean, she definitely wants to sort of help find this cure, but in the background, she's also preparing, because she... She knows, for war? Yeah, she knows that there might not be a resolution, and mm-hmm. she realizes there are people like White Queen, there are people like Magneto.
Right,
who are definitely sort of on the fringe and definitely more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that Soule sort of goes out of his way and shows you every aspect, because we do see Magneto, we do see what he's up to.
And he's
back to his full power. He's okay. Like as deadly as he can.
Super powerful. Is this mainly about the Inhumans royal family, or are there lots of... you mentioned another Inhuman, lady.
Yeah, there's a bunch of Inhumans in here, but there's also all the X-Men, Storm, mm-hmm. you know, dealing with, you know, her side of things while living in a magic's...
Limbo. Yep.
I mean, we see everything. We visit the Savage Land. We see the sort of all out-of-time X-Men, the young team, as sort of White Queen tries to... get them to her side. We see the Hellfire Club and see what they're up to. So Charles Soule sort of takes you on this kind of journey through everything of the X-Men and everything of the Inhumans to show all the sides. And it's an interesting, it's very talkative. I mean, it's not a lot of action.
Bendis's.
Well, no, it's sort of the preamble.
Literally issue zero. So.
Yeah, it is issue zero, and you can kind of see things starting to go bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked every conversation, every interaction felt like those characters. Beast feels very much like classic Hank McCoy, and
so you don't feel like they're pulling the Mark Miller of squeezing the characters to fit the dramatic plot.
Correct. I don't feel like they're making anybody do anything that is outside of their comfort zone. I mean, White Queen is definitely. Evil.
She hasn't been evil lately. She's just a bitch.
Well, I think after Secret Wars and sort of...
Well, Death of X.
Death of X. There's spoilers for Death of X and what actually she did.
Sure. And I know those spoilers. I get the sense that they decided to move her back to the villainous side of things, which honestly, I'm okay with. I'd become okay with Emma Frost
back to the Magneto sort of spot.
I'd become okay with her as sort of an ally to the X-Men. I did not like that when they brought over Generation X. I never bought it. She was a cold-hearted villain when they first introduced her. And I never bought her redemption.
Yeah.
And then Morrison sort of made me buy into it.
Well, you know, this is a weird case where the character's evolution from villain to hero to villain again actually makes sense to me. Yeah. Because in a lot of ways, the only thing that redeemed her was her love for Cyclops.
Yeah, that's true.
She was kind of this pure hero, and it sort of melted her a little bit, but it's still... Well, and, it's like she never fully gave in to being a nice person.
I think Death of X and Avengers vs. X-Men and Secret Wars kind of broke her in a lot of ways because it destroyed her relationship with Cyclops. Yeah. And then what happened in Death of X sort of destroyed her even more. So... I really thought it was a great first issue, or zero issue. There was a lot of meat to chew and some really cool stuff. I will want to do say it is a 6-issue miniseries.
Uh-huh. Okay.
They have a checklist at the back. It looks like it's going to be traveling through a lot of the X books, Extraordinary, Uncanny.
Oh, so it is a crossover.
All new Deadpool and the Mercs for Money. So it looks like people are going to get getting involved. And all the Uncanny Inhumans, so it is a bigger crossover than I was expecting.
It looks like it goes through March, is it?
Yep.
Oh, that's bigger than I thought, yeah.
Yep. Well, I suspect this sets up what we know is coming, which is that a new X-Men initiative that's going to have the blue and gold teams and stuff like that. In fact, there's creative announcements that people can look up online about that, but I'm sure this will set the stage for it.
But for a miniseries I wasn't really expecting to care for, this was a very strong first issue that I really enjoyed.
Well, Sewell's been sort of shepherding the Inhumans all this whole time.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yes. Dave, what is your pick?
Let's see. My pick, I'm going to do something from Valiant that's not Faith for once.
What?
Or Britannia. Yeah. This is a new book called Savage. And it is more in the mainstream Valiant universe than, say, Britannia, which was, you know, kind of... I mean, I think it's going to end up in that place.
We don't actually know.
Yeah, that's true. It could be a standalone concept, but it's not as sort of out there tonally as Britannia
right.
is, which is a really good book, but it doesn't feel like a Valiant book.
Right.
This, Randy, we surmise, and I think it's pretty obvious, that this is their answer to the license they no longer have, Turok.
Well, you know, Divinity is their answer to Solar.
So they have done their own version.
They've been doing, and their Magnus, I don't think they have a Magnus. I guess Rye sort of incorporates.
Well, if they're only getting around to Turok,
they don't really have a Magnus.
That might be something they're coming around to.
Yeah.
So Savage, what I'm trying to prepare y'all is this has dinosaurs.
Yeah.
They cut to it right on the first page when you have, how old would you say this kid is, Randy? He looks like he's in his teens.
Maybe teens.
I would say like 12 or 13.
Yeah, that's our guess.
So, okay. Yeah, he's younger and kind of wiry and skinny, but, you know, he's got a little bit of the Bruce Lee sort of lean physique. But he is tangling with a... it's not a raptor, but it's some kind of creature like that. What's actually kind of cool is I'm looking at the head ridges on
it. Didn't you say it was a Carnosaur or something?
No, a Carnotaur is the other creature that shows up near the end. This one is something different, but it has its very distinct facial markings. I suspect that what they're doing, and this is kind of cool, is using some slightly off the beaten path, but real dinosaurs.
Well, in the behind the scenes that they do at the back of this, which I kind of like that Valiant does this.
Oh, I didn't read it.
They show some art, they show some process stuff, and B. Clay Moore, the writer, talks about how his artist, I think Louis LaRosa, is a huge dinosaur freak.
Oh, nice.
So he, like, brought all this to him, and he's like, yeah, he gave me, like, stats, and so I think, yeah, it's very real dinosaur. And the kid's fighting with, like, a raptor claw that he's using as
right.
his weapon.
He looks almost Tarzan-like, you know, he's got, like, bones and feathers and stuff on him, and, you know, he's using what looks like a dagger that might be a tooth of another dinosaur, he's fighting it hand-to-hand, you know, it's like fighting a raptor hand-to-hand, and it's a big old bloody kind of opening fight.
It's a great opening.
Yeah, it's a very cool opening, and then he kind of goes back to this sort of this hut that has, you know, you see small trappings of the modern world in it. A watch,
it's a lighter.
It's a lighter, yeah, some other stuff. And then it flashes back, and you see sort of the origins of his, of basically how he probably got to this savage land type place.
Mm-hmm.
And you see what presumably is him as a baby on a plane with his parents who are... his dad's like sort of looks like a famous soccer star, UK guy, and is the wife is she like his publicist?
She seems like his publicist, business manager, yeah.
Yeah, and they have a sort of a violent wreck on an island. It's a little shades of what was the Tom Hanks movie?
Castaway.
Castaway, and really Lost. Anything you've ever seen somebody crash on an island with. And you know, it is clear that something is, you know, they haven't connected all the dots, but something is going to occur on this island. There are some things I don't want to say, that there are hints of maybe how it got to the place where presumably in about 10 or 12 years, their kid is fighting dinosaurs on it. But it doesn't seem like they maybe make it off the island.
I thought B. Clay Moore did a really good job with the characters. I felt that the father, you got some kind of pros and cons for him.
You got sort of hints of his alcoholism and that maybe it caused problems with their relationship.
Yeah, they were... I liked both of the characters were well drawn. At first, for just a page or two, I thought it was being a little heavy-handed, but then I sort of warmed to it, and I thought they were good and interesting characters.
I think we all liked this book.
Yeah, it was definitely could have been a runner-up for me.
You know what's interesting is I guess there were two artists on it, right?
Yeah, there was LaRosa, and then there was Clayton Henry, I believe.
Oh, wow. Those are both really good artists.
Yeah, they're both good.
The dinosaur stuff has a sort of painted look that reminds me of, Tim Truman or Doug Wiley back in the day.
You know where we know LaRosa from, right?
Nope.
He did Punisher Max stuff. Some really good Punisher
Clayton
Max
Henry
stuff.
Henry was on something.
So that's the artist who
did the dinosaurs.
Oh, okay, cool. And then when we're getting to the flashbacks with the husband and wife and sort of the how it all came to be, there's a little bit of Steve McNiven to this arc,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
That kind of...
Clayton Henry did some work for Uncanny X-Men during the rise and fall of the Shire Empire. Working on Harbinger and Archer and Armstrong.
So okay, that makes sense. He's a valiant guy.
Yeah, he's a valiant guy.
But yeah, I like the vibe of this where there's a little bit of Tarzan, there's a little bit of Lost and stuff to it. There's kind of, it's going to have this sort of cool survivalist element.
Yeah.
And there's dinosaurs.
Yep.
Valiant's
doing really good first issues.
Yeah, and some mysteries.
And I mean, I want the second issue because I want to know more about this island and more about just everything. It was a very cool first issue.
Yep. So that's my pick, Randy.
My pick is not a first issue. my pick, in fact, is Black Widow number 8. Which is sort of mid-story, I guess, because it's basically the Black Widow is, along with her telepathic telepath named the Weeping Lion, she is looking for these other girls who have been trained by her old mentor and sort of unleashed on these missions in the United States.
Who is the Weeping Lion?
I assume it's an operative out of the new Red Room.
Yes, yeah. The Weeping Lion is this young, sort of a teenager-looking...
Ally?
Ally, enemy-turned ally.
Okay, got it.
Anyway, so Natalie, or Natasha, is posing as a White House tour guide because they somehow found out that one of these Red Room operatives has been sent to assassinate the vice president, but they don't know who or what. And so her telepath is kind of trying to figure it out. She is in disguise as a tour guide and knows nothing about the White House, which is kind of funny because she's giving tours. Uh-huh. And she's like, to your right, you'll see Washington's bedroom. On your left, a portrait of Andrew Jackson. And you see in her head, the telepath's like, no, no.
That's pretty good.
And there's some funny stuff. And then a kid like questions her about it. She's like, President Reagan held a reception for Soviet Union General Secretary Gorbachev. And she gets this look in her eyes. She's like, she starts interrogating her because she thinks, oh, she knows about Gorbachev. She must be the Russian spy. Uh-huh. And she starts the girl crying because she's yelling at her in Russian.
That's
there's some funny bits in there.
It's sort of like era of West Wing when Sam Seaborn is giving like a group of kids a tour and he knows absolutely nothing.
And then it turns into a big action sequence where she's taking on these preteen assassins. Which Samney does just fantastic work with. It's a great setup. It's a really fun story. And even though it is drawing on what's been going on in the book previously, I think you could jump on with it pretty easily. This book, we don't mention it as much as we did like Daredevil. We mentioned every issue. Mm-hmm. But I think it's every bit as good as this Daredevil run. It's really, really good stuff. It is the Black Widow book I've wanted. And it'll definitely be on my best of list that we'll be working on here in a few weeks.
The collaboration with Wade and Samney, they just turned everything into gold.
So this was just, it was just a fun issue that mixes humor, action, and character, all the stuff that Wade does so well with that spectacular Samney art. My backup pick is Serenity, No Power in the Verse number 2, which is...
That came out very quickly. Did you... Serenity?
Serenity, No Power in the Verse number 2.
Got it. Sounded like one crazy gibberish word.
Okay. It's written by Chris Roberson. Pencils continue by Georges Janti, which, of course, is my one downside to the book, and that
he's a fine artist.
He's a solid artist. His storytelling is good. His likenesses are terrible.
Yeah, his likenesses
you may find yourself sometimes wondering, is that Mal talking, or is that
and
somebody else?
All his people look like kids, which worked better on Buffy. Here, all of them look like teenagers, which is really weird. But I get used to it. And the thing is, the book feels and sounds like Serenity. It opens, this is on the first page, so it's not really a spoiler. Mal and crew are surrounded by people with guns. And the first line is, well, this took a turn, which is a very Mal line. And there's some great action sequences with River and the other sort of weapon that they've been traveling with. And some good, a confrontation between Mal and the Doctor on a matter of morality, which always happens. A great Jane moment, and an interesting sort of bad guy that's developing here. So they're definitely building on what happened in the Serenity movie and doing a story that feels like it could have been a Firefly season 2 kind of thing.
I have not read this one yet, but I like the first issue quite a bit. And as you were flipping through, I even saw some of his likenesses were pretty good.
Yeah.
There was more than I'd like that were not. But
I will say everything else is good. I think the action is good.
Yeah.
The storytelling is really good.
I just can't always tell who the characters are.
Yeah.
That said, I do think it's a really good book, and I'm greatly enjoying it. I'm one of these people who, you know, a lot of what makes Serenity work is the performances, and so I don't know how well it translates to books and comics and that kind of thing. But so far, this feels like more of the story I wanted.
Right. You know, if you can feel like that the characters, if they feel like they're the characters from the show in general or the movies that inspire them, then usually they're on a good track, and they're really pulling that off, I feel like.
Dave, what's your backup pick?
My backup pick, this is kind of an oddball one for me. This is first issue of the new Ghost Rider series from Marvel, which I don't know if it's actually called it, but it does on the cover say Robbie Reyes, Ghost Rider, who is, for those, anybody watching S.H.I.E.L.D. right now, that's the Ghost Rider you're going to have seen there, at least a version of him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been Ghost Rider off and on for the Marvel Universe, what, 3-4 years?
I think so.
Something like that.
But he came about right before Secret Wars, right?
Because
Ghost Racers was in Secret Wars, and I think he was Ghost Rider before that.
He was basically about a year before, because they have 2 trades worth, 6 issues each.
It was one of the all new.
Yeah. Yep.
So what you have here is a Hispanic kid from East L.A. He's a teenager Robbie Reyes, and he's sort of, I don't know if, is he, does his younger brother live with him? Randy?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
I think they're orphans. I think their family, their parents are dead or gone.
Yeah, at no point do I see him like just hanging out. I think at home, maybe so. They're more like hanging out where he works, where he's like a mechanic. And, you know, right away, just as with the original miniseries, I kind of fell off the original stuff with Robbie Reyes, but I right away liked that he was kind of a hero in the classic Marvel mold from his double the R first name and last name to, you know, looking out for his brother the same way. Because his kid, like, has some disability. I don't know whether he's supposed to be autistic, his younger brother, or what, but he's got some disability.
And he's his sort of protector, his only family.
It's not unlike how Peter Parker would take care of Aunt May, and, like, a lot of heroes had somebody that they kind of needed to look out for. Yeah. Sometimes it was their boyfriend or girlfriend. Sometimes it's, you know, a relative like this. And, So there's some character establishing stuff with them, and meanwhile there's percolating in the background. There's somewhat unusually, there's a fair amount of screen time given to Amadeus Cho, aka the Totally Awesome Hulk.
Weirdly, it's like half the issue.
It's not that much. Actually.
Okay, it seems like a lot.
I think because the Hulk, when he appears on a page, is so visually larger than life. It does take up a lot of. It seems to take up a lot of visual real estate, but. Amadeus Cho is consulting with some people who are doing some experiments when something goes wrong, and it's clearly going to end up involving Robbie and stuff. And meanwhile, there is a action scene with Robbie who I didn't realize the story of, like, you know, the Ghost Rider traditionally has like a demon that's bonded to him, and in this case, it is the spirit of his uncle, I guess, Uncle Eli, who seems like he seems like a mean old man, like an vengeful guy. It's interesting to see his kind of internal, Robbie's internal monologue sort of debating with him over some stuff at times. And the guy's kind of like, in some ways, sometimes calling out Robbie's manhood, like, you're going to let him talk to you like that. I did actually like it as a change-up from Zarathos and some of the other Ghost Rider personalities, which seemed more like traditional demon-y. And this is a guy who's just like, he's like just a pissed-off dude.
Dave, do you, I'm looking at... Are they doing something that's sort of like the thing that sort of leads young men of color into gangs and kind of thing? Like it's instead of the reference of, you know, the original Ghost Rider was all about Christianity and Satanism and all that kind of thing and the temptations of
right.
Satan.
It was like a Faustian deal by way of Evel Knievel.
Yeah. Instead, this is like the temptation of like the gang life and that kind of thing, as opposed to being a good guy and being with your family and that kind of thing.
I would say that's a pretty good take on it. Robbie is by nature a very kind of family-oriented, nice guy, it's like his uncle, I don't know if he was literally a gang member, I get the vibe he easily could have been, he is pushing him into confrontations, and then there are things because it looks like his neighborhood's got its own pressures, that leads him down that path anyway, And so there's an action sequence where he gets into some trouble that's not supernatural, but he busts out the full fury of the Ghost Rider on this dude. And meanwhile, there is a creature, like a bigger creature that's clearly going to intersect with his life in the second issue. There's also a guest appearance by another Marvel character at the very end. That I will be curious to see how she fits into it too, because it's a Lady Marvel character.
Well, it seems like Felipe Smith is doing what some of the Marvel books have done and utilize the Marvel Universe.
Right, I forgot to say that.
And it's not just, you know, your hero is definitely going to, you know, cross some paths with some other heroes. Yep. And it kind of feels like these are all converging into one big mishmash.
Right. Yeah, I do sometimes. It's a little weird that there's so much like Hulk and this other character at least popping up in the first issue, but I sometimes prefer that to a book in isolation.
Yeah.
It feels easier to not like it, more like it doesn't matter sometimes.
Who's the artist on this book? Because I'm looking at that shot of Los Angeles, and it's really good.
The artist is somebody I'm not real familiar with. Danilo? I don't know how you say that, or if it's like Danilo. Beirut, that's for sure new to me.
Yeah, new artist, I think. Really good, though.
Really good, strong designs and storytelling, good action scenes.
And kind of a style, I mean, it's not easily comparable to anything. It's maybe sort of Joe Eisman and some of the Archie guys a little bit, but I don't know what I easily would compare it to.
Yeah, I'm a little somewhat at a loss on that, too. It's pretty, there's even actually a little of Samney in some of these design work and storytelling.
And I can also see a little Kevin Maguire a little bit.
The faces. One of the things that I like is part of it's the setting, too. He's at grabbing tacos at like a food truck sort of thing here. And they do make out, it says Dona Rosa's famous Taco Loco's food truck, Venice Boulevard, Culver City, Los Angeles. I don't know. I get the feeling it's a real place. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing it is. I don't know it specifically. But, I kind of like the local color. Robbie is an interesting guy because he's, in addition to being a good guy who's battling with his literal demons a little bit, he's also apparently going to be one of these dudes a little bit like Nightwing, who is also, he's hot. There's girls talking about what a babe he is off in the distance. And I'm curious to see what they'll do with that. It seems like he's going to be one of those characters in comics that's notably supposed to be hot.
I also really liked the backup story.
The backup story is fun. Let's see, who's the person he runs into?
Her name is Piston Nitro.
Oh, like the she looks like a Liefeld character.
Well, this is actually a backup story drawn by Chad Moore, who originally drew.
Yeah, so he's got that stylish art sort of thing going on.
And it's sort of just this kind of one-off. I thought the design of Piston Python or Nitro was really interesting. Riding a skateboard of all things.
He's got was it Tradmore? Is that what it is? He's got his own sort of visual style that's a very sort of modern costume design. Mm-hmm. I kind of like it too. His art always has sort of an anarchic wildness that's a little bit manga-esque.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like the anarchic wildness, to steal your description, is fantastic for his muscle car and mm-hmm. sort of the kind of wild chains that he this Ghost Rider has.
By the way, don't motorcycle artists hate drawing cars?
I think most do.
Why did they change it from a motorcycle to a car to make it like it's just got to be a character that people are like? No, I'll do it, but I'm not driving the car because the cars here are great.
Yeah, they look fantastic.
Well, it may have been sort of a Felipe Smith Trad Mork when they originally conceived the idea, and they were like, maybe he likes drawing cars.
Yeah, or it could be one of those things where it's like it or not, that's what's going to be hardcore at the heart of this book. So you better learn to like it. Sure. But I suspect they brought in somebody who they knew was going to enjoy it somewhat. Yeah.
Nick?
My backup pick is a book called No Angel. It's the first issue from Black Mask.
We've talked about these fellows before.
Yes. The interesting thing about this one, this is a book written by Adrian Palicki and her brother, Eric Palicki. So if you know Mockingbird from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or various other places.
You might also know her from the place she occupies in my dreams, because I love Adrian Palicki.
Adrian Palicki is awesome. And it turns out she's a pretty decent comics writer, too.
Good.
And the art here is by Ari Sirazad. Don't know, but...
There are a lot of really good artists these days.
Well, yeah. Like all of Black Mask Studios' work, I mean, they always get something that's unique, and but extremely talented. And the story here sort of talks about... is all about a woman coming back to sort of her hometown. She's a pretty notable police officer, detective in another state, but she comes home to sort of when her brother and father are murdered. And it's sort of reconnecting with life in her hometown while dealing with the murder and the, you know, burying her father and brother, dealing with her grieved mother.
Is this all real life stuff? Is there any supernatural or superpowers?
There are, as you slowly get further and further into it, there's definitely some supernatural stuff. I don't want to reveal exactly what it is because
Are there angels?
Yeah, I mean,
because the cover says no angel.
Exactly.
So I want to know if they're lying to us.
Well,
or being ironic.
They may or may not be lying to you.
Oh, okay.
No, but there are some
supernatural... Nick said with a wing.
There are some supernatural elements. I just thought it was a really, really well put together story.
Would you compare this to something like Southern Bastards or one of those where it's like somebody coming to a corrupt town as a force of good, or is that not really...
It's not quite there. It's kind of its own thing. I mean, we've seen bits and pieces
David
of this.
S. Pumpkins.
Yes, it is like David S. Pumpkins in comic book form.
Never forget.
It's really too bad we're not doing written reviews anymore because I'd really like them to splash across the trade. It's like David S. Pumpkins.
No, but I actually thought there was a lot of heart in here. The conversations between her and her mother were very interesting and realistic in the portrayal of sort of loss and grief. And then you get to sort of the supernatural angle and sort of the dangers, and it's interesting, different, and yeah, I think people should take a look at this one, because I enjoyed it, and I really don't want to spoil the supernatural
angle. It sounds like something in general for Image fans to check out, which is a big chunk of our readership here at Rogues. I imagine this might hold some interest.
But another win for Black Mask Comics. Randy, what is your...
We already did my backup pick.
Yeah,
what's the rest of your stuff?
Oh, okay. All right, so what else do I have? I have the third issue of Seven to Eternity, Rick Remender's sort of fantasy book. I know Dave was big into it.
Yep. I haven't had a chance to read this full issue yet, but I have been enjoying this series quite a bit.
I was able to get a chance to read this one, and this sort of picks up exactly where the last one left off. Big action piece. And then it sort of takes a turn in an interesting direction that I wasn't expecting. So, it is a very cool third issue.
The, for a fantasy story, somehow this, story of a, dictator called the Mud King who, they say will grant the, can see the wishes in darkness that men hide in their hearts. The Mud King will grant them their desires in exchange for letting him see through their eyes and hear through their ears. Mm-hmm. So it's like he's got kind of people everywhere.
Exactly.
I feel like it's going to like feel more and more relevant. Probably.
Really?
I don't know. I don't know why. I know there's like magic and weird creatures and stuff. It just feels like that sort of dictatorship has a relevance right now.
Do you think maybe we're going to get magic and weird creatures?
please, God. At least have magic with this.
I will say, if you didn't get a chance to read the second issue, the second print of that does hit tomorrow as well.
Nice.
Then there's a couple of annuals that hit this week. There's a Batman annual, which is sort of a jam issue with a bunch of talented people, like Tom King, Scott Snyder, Ray Fox, Paul Dini does a story.
Huh.
Artist like Riley Rosmo.
Yeah, Paul Dini actually teams with Neil Adams for a Harley Quinn like holiday story. I haven't had a chance to see how it comes off, but it looked fun.
Then there's a Superman annual by Peter Tomasi, and
it's Superman
dealing with Superman and Swamp Thing. Which is very fun. Then there's the second issue of Great Lakes Avengers, the antics of the. They're based in Detroit. Is that correct?
I think that's right.
Yep, Detroit. That's what it says. The team nobody wanted continues. It was a lot of fun. Then there's the New Talent Showcase from DC, which is another jam issue featuring some creative talents that we may or may not have seen in places before.
There's a lot of good new artists on this.
Yeah, there are. There's a lot of talent.
I didn't get a chance to read it because it's kind of an oversized issue, but it's got
cool characters in it, though. Deadman, Catwoman. Is that Wonder Girl?
Wonder Girl, yeah, Hawk Wonder Girl. Harley Quinn.
Is there a Wonder Girl in the current DC?
Yeah, Cassie Sandsmark is a Wonder Girl.
Oh, right.
But this, I want to say the, and there's this that has Green Lantern, or I guess Kyle Rayner and Carol Ferris, the art by Barnaby Baginda.
Yeah.
Really nice. I thought kind of shades of, who did the Adam Strange Planet Heist?
Oh, Pascal Ferry.
Yeah, very Pascal Ferry for me. It was really, really nice.
The opening stuff by Saya I feel like that's a character, somebody who's done like Dr. Fate or something, doing a Hellblazer story is also really nice and sort of painty looking. Yeah, there's some impressive new artists here, a lot of different styles. And I didn't get a chance to read it, but I know there's a bunch of writers who are sort of new to the industry as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, they pair up with, like, the Wonder Girl is drawn by Emanuela Lupacino, who's done things for DC before, but I guess Hinnicon. I love the DC's doing this, just trying to find new talent.
Well, and also, there's workshops with working with 8 talented writers and 8 talented artists. So there's a workshop being shepherded by Bobby Chase. And I feel like some of the, Jim Lee and Klaus Janson were involved in sort of shepherding them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a 13-week program that is sort of trying to teach comic fundamentals to new talent. It's an interesting idea, and I'm behind the idea very much. So also, if you're one of those people who, like, want to get on board the new person who might be the next, like, Jim Lee or Greg Capullo or whatever, and you want to get their first appearance, somebody here will probably go on to be an A-list artist.
Yeah, somebody in here is going to break out. And then the only other thing I have is the first issue of MASK, Mobile Armored Strike Command.
I was going to say, please say what it stands for if you haven't.
And,
if you don't already.
And the command is spelled with a K.
Yeah, I just noticed that. It's a little creepy.
but this is basically the 80s toy license sort of coming.
Vehicles that transformed into different vehicles, if I think, was
they
sort
were
of their
like
hook?
Regular vehicles turning into like armored and weaponized
gunned up, yeah.
So, yeah, and it feels different from the original, but
there's enough
there.
There's a certain G.I. Joe-ness to it. They had like their heroic dudes, and they had their like evil organization of vehicle-changing dudes.
Yeah, it's basically Mask versus Venom. It was fun.
Yep.
What else do you got, Dave?
I believe there is nothing else that I have other than I was going to mention the comic that we got through, self-publisher, Randy?
Yeah.
Matthew Gallman. His book is Captain Longbeard, and is a very fun-looking all-ages book with art that I might liken a little bit to, like, Jeff Smith or, Chris Schweitzer, you know, somewhere between those. He's got a little bit of Schweitzer's sort of detail and backgrounds, a little bit of Jeff Smith's kind of line quality.
Yeah.
And is a tongue-in-cheek tale of, like, crazy, goofy piracy. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but it looked like a lot of fun. I think kids who are growing up in that era of SpongeBob, Adventure Time, all of that kind of stuff are going to have a good chance to enjoy this. And it's really well crafted.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I said. We get emails from creators every time, from time to time, and a lot of them are just sort of, hey, would you like to carry our book? And the fact of the matter is, we just don't have time to deal with every individual creator.
Right.
We have to sort of be pretty draconian. And this one sort of made it through because the art looks so good. So
yep.
We just got it. Haven't had a chance to look through it. But it definitely made our cut, so it's probably worth a look.
Yep.
On my list, I've got Star Wars Annual number 2. And I know I've griped about annuals on this podcast before, but I feel like the Star Wars books know what to do with annuals. They tend to use it to introduce a new character who will then come back into the books. That was what they did with last one. That was a sort of a undercover agent with it for the rebellion who sort of turned against them.
Mm-hmm.
This one is written by Kelly Thompson, who is best known as the writer of the new Gem reboot.
Yeah.
She also did A-Force.
Okay.
With an artist named Emilio Liso, who I don't know, but who does really nice stuff.
Sure.
And this is basically it introduces a character named, I think her name is, they call her Bash. But her name is Pash Devane. She lives on a sort of, there's a crashed Star Destroyer. What's the planet in?
Jakku?
So it looks like a Jakku type planet.
Is it actually?
It is not Jakku, but it seems very similar. It's during the course of the rebellion, so it's not like the fall of the Empire. It's clearly a battle has taken place. She used to be an engineer. The rebellion has sort of taken everything for her, and now she's like a scavenger, and she's sort of bitter about it. And she really just kind of wants to take no sides in this whole thing. She's the rebellion's in big trouble. She doesn't like the Empire either, but she's just like, the rebellion's just causing issues for regular people.
Yeah.
And then a injured Princess Leia falls into her lap, and she's forced to sort of take sides. And it's sort of a buddy comedy between an injured Princess Leia and a sort of scrappy, tough guy woman. And
Tough gal.
And trying to get her off planet before the Empire or bounty hunters get to her. It's really fun, really action-y.
And she's in full-on scrappy mode herself, I would assume.
Yeah, well, she's sort of doing the thing that Wade did in his miniseries, where she is basically, she's an action hero of sorts here, and she's basically doesn't know if she can trust this other woman.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good sort of buddy comedy here. There's a little bit of that sort of Midnight Run, that kind of thing.
Sure.
I really like the chemistry between the two characters, and It's a really good story. It's got a nice sort of message to it, and introduced a character who I'm sure we'll see back in the rebellion. So it's a good standalone that will feed back into the series. And I was very pleased with this. It was my basically tertiary pick of the week.
People get all primed for Rogue One.
Indeed. Also on my list, Ms. Marvel number 13, which is the election issue of Ms. Marvel, basically. Saga number 40, which continues the stories that have been going on there. The Skeptics number 2, which is the Cold War fake psychic story from Black Mask. And then Voltron number 5, which wraps up the Voltron miniseries and is a pretty solid issue. I also want to mention ton of trades this week. It's a somewhat of a light week. There's a couple of blank shelves.
Well, I was talking about this with Tila and Dave. This is the fifth week.
Right.
So it's a little lighter.
That explains why last week was kind of light, too. They always split the last couple weeks into
it. I feel weeks like this exist to give people an opportunity to put a little bit of that money towards graphic novels and stuff for gifts for the holidays.
Well, that's where I was going.
Oh, my
because
goodness.
There's a whole bunch of trades this week. So,
such as?
The Vision Volume 2, which completes the Tom King's run, which I need to catch up on before we do our best of, because apparently this is one of the best series of the year.
It's much ballyhooed.
It is, yeah. It's like, I think it's on Amazon's list, it's on the New York Times list, it's probably on any number of other bestsellers lists, so if you're waiting for the second volume of The Vision, the whole series is now collected in two trades. Paper Girls Volume 2, which has also been quite the hit. Moon Knight Volume 1 by Jeff Lemire and Greg Smallwood. Love this book, and glad to see it collected.
Get in on the insanity.
Yes. Then there's a few older things reprinted. Luke Cage and Iron Fist and the Heroes for Hire. This is a John Ostrander book from the 90s that brought back Heroes for Hire. And in addition to it being Iron Fist and Power Man, it was based out of Oracle, which was Namor's old company,
which
was being run by a then depowered original Human Torch, Jim Hammond.
Yeah, and that came from John Byrne's Iron Fist run?
And the team, run, the team in Namor run. Because Iron Fist came back in that run.
Right, that's right.
The team includes the Hulk, Hercules, White Tiger, and the Black Knight.
It's a weird team, but I remember I had a few issues from this from the 90s, and it was really good.
It's really good. It also has early art by Pascal Ferry, and it's Roger Stern did some co-writing on it, and he's the guy who really did some of the best stuff with the Black Knight. It's a really good series. Some of the art's a little 90s,
yep.
But I really dug it. Then going back not quite as far, or not quite as yeah, not going back as far, is the Young Avengers collection, which is this is the complete collection of all the Young Avengers stuff that Alan Heinberg and Jim Chung did, which is the 12 original issues.
Does it also have children's
Plus the plus a special, plus a couple of one shot stories. Okay. Plus the Children's Crusade story,
oh,
yeah.
Wow, that is a...
Actually, you know what? The Children's Crusade is not in here.
I was going to say, because that was a big trade in yeah. itself.
Yeah.
This looks like it's sort of a remastered Volume 1 with some extra stuff that probably wasn't in there originally.
Yep.
And I bet they'll do a second volume that has Children's Crusade and probably a little bit of extra more stuff.
Yeah, but Wiccan, Hulkling, Patriot, all these characters that I think people really like that have sort of scattered to different places in the Marvel Universe. Yeah. This is some really good stuff.
At their height.
And finally... the Robin collection of the Chuck Dixon stuff gets to Volume 3, which, weirdly enough, because Robin started as, like, three miniseries,
yeah.
is finally getting into the ongoing series that, yep. that went for, like, 100-some issues.
Yep.
I saw a spoiler in there. Looked like maybe she was introduced.
I believe Spoilers is introduced in here. I'm not sure about that. I know that John Paul Valley, this is when Azrael Batman was in there, and he sort of breaks off from him. Yeah. There's also some showcase issues. So basically this is Robin number 1 through 5, Robin Annual number 1 through 2, and Showcase 93, number 5 through 6 and 11 through 12, all by Chuck Dixon and the art team of Tom Grummett and Scott Hanna. This is some of my favorite Robin stuff. This is definitely some of the best Tim Drake stuff. So if you're a Tim Drake fan and you're not seeing him in the modern DC Universe... because he's been sequestered. I won't get into that, but it made me unhappy. This is some classic Tim Drake stuff, and it comes out in that trade this week. I think that is everything for us for comics this week.
Yep.
We'll be back in just a second. We're going to talk about a bunch of podcasts, a couple board games, and a TV show. We have a bunch of podcasts to recommend this week, but we're going to close out with that. I'm going to start with Dave came in a rare appearance to my board game night, and we played a bunch of board games.
Way to make me feel self-conscious about it, Randy.
Sorry. No, I was glad because you never come and I never get to play board games with you.
Yeah.
So I had the pleasure of playing not one, not two, but three board games with you this weekend. Yeah. One of them was Pandemic Legacy, which we're all loving, and we won't spoil because these two convinced me that the spoil Pandemic was a mean thing to do.
Yes. It was right then and it's right now.
Yeah.
But what was it? We lost our first game, which we thought we were going to, but we almost pulled it out, so it was exciting.
Yeah.
And then the second game of it, we did much better on. I think we realized we fumbled a slight thing.
To discover that we could have played a completely different game, yes.
A small one of the reveals on it. But it was a satisfying win with some cool sort of chase sequence-y stuff, so that was cool.
We're into month 10 of Pandemic Legacy, and I cannot recommend this game highly enough. It is, of all the games I've played this year, and I've played 30 new games this year, Pandemic Legacy is 100% my favorite.
And you know what? It's one of those where, when you think about it, it's weird to think of a game that's essentially a one-time playthrough. Like I still have to think. Oh, that sounds so weird. You know, like, what if you know? Are you going to get your money's worth out of it? We've already gotten our money's worth.
Definitely getting our money's worth. Yeah, because essentially the number of sessions we've played
more than any other game.
It basically works out to spending $5 between five people,
right?
Or four people every month.
Yep.
And so if you get a game group that goes in on buying it, everybody's spending a buck every time you play. That's pretty cheap. That's cheaper than buying pizza for the group.
And also, it's one of those things where once it's done, I mean, I can already tell based on all of its twists and turns and the close calls and the crushing defeats sometimes that we've had. It's going to be one we're going to talk about forever.
Yep.
And so you are buying an experience with this. It's not just buying a game that you're going to play a little bit more often than other games during the course of the year. It's going to be an experience that you're going to look back on that's unlike any other game you've ever played.
I've become a huge fan of the Legacy format, and I am psyched to play another one at some point.
Yep.
But the other ones we played this weekend, we played Mysterium,
Right.
Which was our Gaming with Rogues selection this month.
That's one of those games that I'd been wanting to play for a long time, and it just had not crossed my path until finally this time.
It's a up to seven players.
Yeah.
So one player plays the ghost, and the ghost is not able to talk.
Yes.
They're not supposed to talk at all. The only way they communicate is by holding up, basically
handing out rather.
Holding up too, because they have a little tab for each person.
But
basically,
right.
There's the six players who are not the ghost play psychics. It's like a 1920s,
yep.
And you have a character card that represents your psychic, and you are trying to talk to this ghost and figure out who murdered them.
Yep.
And the ghost is confused by its death, so it doesn't know exactly either. So it's sort of giving impressions.
Right. As the game begins, it's only in the final, as the game nears its end, that the player playing the ghost will actually know who the ghost is.
Right.
So the players during the course of the game are trying to assemble a list of suspects. Each one gets a killer,
a place, and a weapon.
Right. Very much like Clue.
And it's all cards. There's like all these cards of weapons laid out. There's all these cards of places, and there's all these cards of people. And there's different. They're beautiful visuals. It's kind of like Dixit. They've got really nicely painted.
Lots of detail in them, which is important because of how the ghost communicates.
And the way the ghost communicates is that he or she will hold up a tab indicating which character it is, and then will hand that character some clues, which are artwork. And they've got to use like little things in this artwork to sort of indicate which person. First, and then which place, and then which weapon. And these are very abstract. Like, there was one that was like a mouse in a top hat.
Yeah, it was like he had like that, or like a little Napoleonic uniform. And there's usually lots of elements going on in the picture, so you try and figure out which one do they want you to pay attention to. So as an example, like, there's one of the killers is like this seamstress, one of the suspects, at least. And I remember at some point somebody had like some hot air balloons that were held by tethers and stuff.
And we thought that might be like the pin cushions.
Right. It looked like the strings for like the thread of the needles and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the ghost can sometimes give out multiple cards. So sometimes you might there were once or twice where I got two cards and I'm like, I know almost beyond a shadow of a doubt that between these two cards, he means for me to get to this person or this room or whatever. But a lot of times it's ambiguous and you debate it with the other players.
Yes, as psychics, you're all sort of working together to sort of figure things out. By the way, then there was the Highlander fiasco, which was kind of hilarious. But the girlfriend of the ghost was also playing with us. And the ghost was getting a little frustrated because he couldn't communicate to us. But we had this whole thing where there's a Scotsman with like bagpipes. And she had all these cards. It was like balloons and a high bicycle and cliffs. And we're like, oh, that's all. They're all high. It's a cliff toward Highlander. And he's a Highlander. And basically she's had to explain to us, he doesn't know what a Highlander is. That's not what the reference is.
Yeah. As we were talking about, I think we were like, this makes a lot of sense if he knows the word Highlander. If he doesn't, then it makes no sense. So, but the game has these kind of fun, silly moments like that. It's kind of low pressure.
Mm-hmm.
As these cards are being dealt out to each person in turn, the group freely discusses all of them, and it's only when the very last one has been dealt that a little, like, two-minute timer gets flipped. And at the end of that, everybody has to have finalized who they think that their person or place or murder weapon is supposed to be that round, and also put down some little cards that advance you in the game, where you kind of... It's like you bet on whether a person is right or wrong based on how well you think they've interpreted their own card.
Yeah, it was a fun mechanic.
Yeah, and that helps at the end. The more you get right with that, the guesses essentially you get are the better options for the final prediction of who the bad guys are,
right,
the killer
right.
was. But I like this game a lot because of the – well, first of all, there's really nothing else like it, even though it does seem like a little bit like some weird reverse Clue meets Dixit on the surface.
Yeah, that's the easy pitch, but it's really not that.
It's really not that, yeah. It's really a game of fun interpretations of pictures discussed and debated with people with your fellow psychics in it.
Yep.
With a cool theme of murder mystery, like – The ghost even has, like, on his little card, it looks like a DM screen for an RPG, and it's where he's got his information that he's supposed to use. He has these little ravens that perch on it, and, like, sometimes he needs to draw new cards because he might have cards that, you know, the challenge for the ghost is that sometimes he'll get cards that don't easily represent what he wants to communicate.
Yeah.
And he's got to figure out, well, can I get it across with two cards or even three? Or do I just have to hand out some cards and this one is just going to be a wash for him because I have no connection to what they're looking at, or at least nothing he can easily find.
Sometimes those psychic connections just don't match.
They fizzle. But the ravens, you get to activate three times per round, per game, and, you know, they sort of let you redraw your hand. So the ghost is not completely stuck if he sometimes gets a bad draw of cards.
Right.
And next time I play it, I really want to play the Ghosts.
Yeah, it seems like the hardest role.
It does, it does.
By the way, we do have that game. If you are a member, that game is in our board game lending library, in complete with Ghost Mask, by the way.
Yes, which was a unique thing from, like one of the game days.
Yeah, although it is currently checked out.
It's currently checked out, but it'll be back soon.
It sounds like such a fun game.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then we played Spartacus, a game of blood and treachery, which is based on the Spartacus TV show, which is...
Yes.
Over, right?
Yeah, it did wrap up. But I think it went like 3 or 4 seasons.
On Starz? I believe it was on Starz. It was run by Stephen S. DeKnight, who is running Daredevil now.
It had lots of sex and violence and swearing. It was very hard R-rated.
Yep.
But also gave you a kind of a fun debauched picture of rival Roman, politicians and gladiator and people who run like gladiator schools.
Yep.
Which is in the game, that's what you play. You're all rival. That you're a Dominus, the master of a gladiator school.
Yep, and you have your goal is to get to 12 influence, and so you do that by using these cards that represent schemes. You're scheming against the other people, and you recruit slaves, you recruit gladiators, and there's a little bit of that. It's a little Battlestar Galactica, a little bit sort of resource management, somewhat.
Right. Yeah. You among yourself, you have to balance out. You have to make sure your school is profitable.
Yeah.
You also want to knock down a peg at people who are dangerous rivals.
Yep.
And that means you'll be both allying with people and betraying those allies throughout the game.
Yeah.
It has a lot of opportunities for free trading in it where you can make any deal you want and you don't even have to keep the deal.
That was what was interesting. This is, they talk about, diplomacy is that game that ends friendships. This could easily be that if you're the wrong group of people, because this is very much they say you can promise anything, like to get people to go in on a scheme. Sometimes you need 20 influence, which you can't do as one person.
Yeah.
So you need to grab two people and go in a scheme with somebody else, and you promise them things like, oh, well, I'll give you one of my gladiators and I'll pay you 5 gold and then you can just say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Have made a serious enemy.
Yes.
I mean, is there any recourse other than...
Nope, they can screw you on the next one and stop going on your schemes, but there's no, they can't say, hey, you promised me this, you need to do this instead. No, you just say, no, I was lying.
The final round is an opportunity to potentially take out the grudges in the bloodiest way possible.
Well, the final round, each turn...
Right, or the final turn.
Each turn has several phases. There's, the refresh phase, then the intrigue where you run these schemes against each other, then the trading phase where slaves and gladiators and weapons all come up on the market and you guys bid against them.
Yep.
And then you bid to be the host.
The host of gladiator games.
The host gets to call two people in to be the gladiators, and they can call themselves if they want to try and gain some influence from having a winning gladiator, or they can call two other people. Like on the first turn, Dave called me in, even though I had exhausted all my gladiators, and I had to turn him down and lose an influence, and I never forgave him.
Yes.
In fact, I pursued him the rest of the game.
And in fact, I did very poorly in the game because I was still figuring out the mechanics, and I suck. So I was never able to get my Gladiator Academy on I feel like even on its feet. but it was still fun. Each one of you gets my guy did come with a little bit more gladiators than other people had, but fewer slaves. Some people have more slaves, which bring in basic income.
Everybody has different abilities they can use. My guy could exhaust slaves for intrigues.
Jose had a dude who could, whenever anybody got paid from the bank, he got a single gold out of it.
He was accumulating wealth over there.
Oh yeah. He must've been some kind of money changer type. But when you actually have your gladiators battle, you put miniatures out on a little hexagonal gladiator arena, and with some dice little pools of dice that you have that represent their attack, their defense, and their movement.
Speed. Yeah.
You very quickly, but with a lot of flavor, battle it out in the arena. Literally, moving around. Using your special weapons, special attacks, as you get better, you're going to get better gladiators. You're going to bid on tougher gladiators and get them some gear and weapons.
And everybody can bet on it, so you can bet on who's going to win. And there's corners of the board where you put coins and your little markers for your house.
Higher payouts for.
And so you can bet on who's going to win. There's also a higher payout, a 2-to-1 payout, if you bet on injury or decapitation.
Yeah.
And that happens with this. this sounded really complicated, but it was actually really easy to get going. And yes. The little mini game of having a like gladiator battle at the end of this game of intrigue and trading works really
it's
well.
It's kind of a nice release at that point. So and it's fun to watch even if you're not in the battle.
Yeah.
So where Firefly captures sort of the feel of Firefly.
Yeah.
Does Spartacus, I know you watch the show.
Yeah, I would say so. It captures sort of the grand, not so much like Spartacus as a show was somewhat focused. It had like an ensemble, but it was a lot of it was focused on Spartacus himself getting revenge for the death of his wife and all of this stuff. So it was not a revenge game, and in that sense, it doesn't represent it. But as far as like that the kind of seedy side of Rome, and you know the power mongering, the dirty tricks. The violence and all of that, it absolutely does. So I do feel like it is hugely thematic.
And Dave and I discovered that, and by the way, I've only seen like 20 minutes of an episode of Spartacus, and I felt I loved this game. So you definitely don't need to have seen the show.
Right.
Dave and I discovered that there is another game, X-Men Mutant Revolution, that is basically a reskinned version of this, but with the X-Men.
Right.
So instead of being gladiator schools, you represent either Magneto, Storm, Wolverine, or Cyclops.
It's sort of like the rival mutant leaders with different philosophies.
Well, yeah. The Magneto's the Brotherhood of Mutants. Jean Grey, there's the Jean Grey school is Wolverine. The new Xavier school is Cyclops. And the X-Men is Storm.
Right.
Those are the teams.
It was very specifically kind of the way things were maybe about 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
But constant enough is, you know, the mutants are always kind of a little bit.
Yeah, and it's sort of a little bit mutant Civil War. You're sort of, instead of schemes, you have, I forget what they call it, like actions. Instead of gold, you have hope points.
Right.
And the goal is to become like the revolutionary, and you spend hope points to recruit basically other mutants. So you recruit all these people to your team.
If I'm not mistaken, Randy, these slaves in it were replaced by like students at the school.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember reading or listening to a review once that seemed to indicate that there was a little bit more forced cooperative elements, like threats where you might have to essentially work together on them, and it's not always just dueling with your fellow mutants.
Right, yeah.
Which was a new mechanic that they sort of brought in there. But I'm anxious to try it out now that we know the basic style of these games.
Me too. I took a look, and it's really interesting. If you're a fan of the X-Men, if you're looking for a good superhero game for the holidays, I would definitely point you to this one, because Spartacus was fun, and having looked through the X-Men one, I'm excited to play it. I want to mention a show that I've been watching. I have a TV podcast. Actually, I have two TV podcasts, Beach Cop Detectives and TV Dudes, and I talk about a lot of TV there. One of the shows we're working on our top 10 of the year is HBO's Insecure, which is a show about she had a web show, Issa Rae, and she joined with producer Larry Wilmore and did an 8-episode run on HBO. It's about a woman, Issa Rae is playing sort of herself.
Uh-huh.
She is, she works at a nonprofit that sort of works with inner city kids and is trying to sort of, give these at-risk kids, things that they can enjoy, like the whole thing in her plot this season is about getting them a beach day.
Okay.
And she works with all these well-meaning white people who don't have any idea what they're talking about.
Right.
Her best friend Molly works at like this corporate like bank job, and the two of them, it's about sort of them getting by in this world at the same time dealing with romance. Molly is someone who cannot seem to keep a boyfriend. She keeps self-destructing a little bit. And Issa starts out with her boyfriend, Lawrence, who she lives with, who we think is sort of a slacker guy. But then we see that she sort of put him in that hole. And Lawrence is actually a pretty good guy. But she's sort of veering toward this other guy she knew from high school that's like her fallback guy.
Okay.
And so it's relationships. It's also work stuff. It has a voice.
Those are two pretty interesting directions.
It has a voice unlike anything I've seen. It's very, very funny, but it's also very real.
Half hour.
It is a comedy, but it's got some strong drama chops, and I just loved it. I watched every episode. I sort of watched episodes 1 and 2, and I fell a little behind, and I binged basically 3 through 7 in a couple days. And this is just a fantastic show. It's definitely something people on radar should be on the radar.
Huh? Insecure is that?
Insecure is what it's called on HBO. All right, let's talk podcasts.
Because there's a lot of podcasts.
Because we discovered a bunch of podcasts. Well, Gimlet did their big Gimlet Media, which does Reply All and Startup and a bunch of stuff that we've listened to and talked to the Mystery Show at some point.
Yeah.
They did their sort of fall shows. They launched like 4 new shows.
Right.
Two of which I know we at least at least you and I, Nick, listened to. And Dave, I don't know if you listened to all of them or not.
I think most of these I don't think I have.
So one is Homecoming.
Yes.
Which is a story podcast, kind of like Black Tapes or any of those. And the interesting thing about this is the voice cast they've got.
This is basically what you would expect from a Hollywood production.
Yeah, it's like A-list talent.
Because you have the main character is Catherine Keener.
Catherine Keener.
Who's that? A running joke. I can't remember who Catherine Keener is.
Yeah, Dave does not remember Catherine Keener. 40-year-old virgin?
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
She's the woman.
Okay.
She's his girlfriend.
And Being John Malkovich.
He doesn't remember Being John Malkovich.
I haven't seen it.
She's from a bunch of stuff.
But I got it from 40-year-old virgin.
See, I knew there was something. That's what it was.
And basically she plays a...
She's a counselor, at the Homecoming Initiative, which is seems to be something that the Department of Defense is doing for returning soldiers, including one played by Oscar Isaac.
So,
Her boss is played by David Schwimmer, and that guy's a big jerk. not David Schwimmer.
He's good at playing jerks.
But he is great at playing jerks.
Yeah. So they're doing some kind of, she's like a counselor for guys coming back from war, and they're living in some kind of facility. It's called the Homecoming Initiative. But there's a framing story where she's a waitress at some diner, and a guy from the DOD comes to talk to her, and she seems very nervous and cagey about the whole thing. And clearly, that was like 5 years ago, so clearly something went wrong with the Homecoming Initiative, and there's something deeper there.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's more to the Homecoming Initiative, because it is about soldiers returning, and most of those soldiers do have some sort of, problem, or, adjusting back to the real world.
I'm wondering if it's like a psychological programming thing, like they're creating Manchurian candidates or something like that.
I've definitely considered that. But the performances by Oscar Isaac,
all the performances are fantastic. There's two out so far.
And then the second one with him and sort of the other member from his company.
Yeah, there's some great paranoia stuff there.
And that scene was just really, really good.
Check it out. I love paranoia stuff.
And it's cool that because after the podcast, they do a little behind the scenes.
Yeah.
After every episode, they kind of bring in one member of the cast or crew or something. And
The first episode has after the end of the podcast, and this is a relatively short podcast.
Yeah, they're about 20, 25 minutes.
At the end.
Five sessions.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quick interview between, I can't remember if it's the Gimlet's founder, someone who talks to the creator of the show. In the first one, they talk sort of about developing it. In the second one, and all preceding, the creator of the show is going to talk to somebody. And in the second one, he talks to the other actor who was working with Oscar Isaac and talks about that scene and how they did it. And the behind-the-scenes stuff's really interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I don't usually see a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff on podcasts. Like, in some ways, I kind of, this is just how I process, behind-the-scenes stuff almost on almost everything, is sometimes I don't want to see it because I don't want the magic, the illusion that I invest in it, the suspension of disbelief spoiled. But that's interesting because just podcasts don't tend to get a lot of process stuff.
But the production value here is fantastic. Yeah. All the it's perfect clarity, great, use of effects here and there.
Yeah.
It's just awesome.
It's going to force stuff like Black Tapes and even Bright sort of Sessions to step up their game because this feels like a major production.
Yeah.
The other show they're doing is called Crime Town.
Yep.
Which is about it's a real story about Providence, Rhode Island, which apparently was a big mob town, and it's about their mayor Buddy Cianci, who died recently. But it's about he was sort of this corrupt mayor, and it opens with this police report of he tortured this guy.
Yeah, he stubbed a cigarette in his eye.
Yeah.
It was broke his arm.
Yeah.
It
was an indictment against him right before he ran successfully for re-election.
Correct.
So it's all about, but the other thing is they're showing us that maybe he was this tough guy because the mob ran this whole town and he was the guy who stood up to him. So it starts with him as a prosecutor. And then they talk to some of the mobsters who worked that area.
Yeah, I think each podcast has a different sort of aspect of kind of tackling this thing. Because I've only listened to two of them.
Me too.
The third one
dropped, but I haven't listened to it yet.
Because the second one I thought was so interesting because they basically look at two enforcers and how exactly they got to be where they were.
They talk about them starting as a teenager and going to the jail and where they met the mobsters.
One was living on the streets. Yeah. One was in the military.
Yeah.
And came back and sort of.
One was a dungeon master. They talk about him playing D&D. It's hilarious. But what's funny is listening to that second episode, especially all of this, it scratches that itch that Goodfellas got for me. That's so. They're so you don't want to root for them, but they do such a good job of humanizing these guys and sort of normalizing their sort of criminal behavior in the world they were in. And and you well, see the little details
they
of it.
I thought it was normal.
Yeah.
And that well, was just the other
what
life.
I think is one of them is sort of self-aware. He's like, he's talking about sort of these things he did, and he's like, my philosophy is, if you're going to be a good guy, that's fine, be a good guy. If you're going to be a bad guy, you better be good at it.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's very memorable. It's like watching a mob movie, but on podcast form. I'm loving this podcast.
But then you have to realize it's real.
Yeah. Yeah.
This one is not a story podcast.
So was Goodfellas.
Yeah.
So, in the same way, sort of Goodfellas and Wolf of Wall Street sort of glamorize these bad guys, but it also does usually show the bad ends they come to. So, it's fascinating and really, really well done. The other one, Nick, that you and I had listened to, and I think Dave listened to a little bit, was Life After.
I listened to the first episode.
And I've listened to the first episode as well. And it's, and
I listened to it before y'all, and I told y'all about it.
And I've listened to the first three. I've beat you both.
Yes.
But this is the people who did The Message.
Yes.
Which you and I really liked, Nick?
No. Y'all didn't like, or y'all were lukewarm on, and I liked.
Oh, okay.
That was the one that was the sort of the weird alien extraterrestrial transmission, and I guess
it had an interesting concept. I don't think it always worked in execution.
My big beef was with the ending. I thought the ending was hackneyed.
I can't remember quite enough of it to get into it. But it was interesting because it was a very polished production that had a lot of. Strong voice. It didn't have notable voice actors in it, but it had strong voice acting and audio effects.
Well, isn't this wasn't done by like GE?
Yes, this
yeah,
is
it
actually,
had like a big sponsor.
This is actually a GE's sort of. They take an aspect of sort of technology and sort of focused on it. The Message was all about sort of musical, basically music and tech
and linguistics.
Linguistics,
yeah. Before the recent movie Arrival came along, it was a very notable thing about. Where an alien communication was at the very core of this podcast.
Oh, man, you're right. If people like The Arrival, they should definitely listen to The Message.
Yeah, it's probably a good time to jump back. It's like short.
It's like 8 episodes?
8 episodes, yeah. And I think they're about 20 minutes each.
I listened to it in one shot on a road trip, actually.
Interesting.
Yeah.
This new one, The Life After, has something of a Black Mirror vibe.
Very much so.
Yes.
And the concept is sort of it begins with a piece of technology in a way. They even have a fake ad for it at the beginning that sounds so real that it confused me.
I had the same thing. I was like, oh, come on.
They put they just started the podcast literally 15 seconds ago and they went right into an ad.
Yeah. We can talk about the technology.
Yeah, I think so.
Technology is a thing called Voice Tree.
It's basically Facebook with voices. So you get 60-second voice posts.
Right.
But this is definitely taking place in our reality in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's about a kind of pencil pusher. Well, not a pencil pusher, but
a guy who works in the FBI's
social media
division.
Oh, right. Crime division.
Yeah. And his name is Ross, and he lost his wife 8 months ago.
And he's not getting over
it. Sort of obsessed with listening to her posts on VoiceTree. And there's a real interesting – there's a great twist in there about her posts and what they actually mean.
Right. So they jump around – they flash back to him a little bit and jump around a bit in time sort of to so that context kind of emerges as the episode goes along.
But it's also about his friends like trying to get him out of the dating world again. And his performance at work is suffering because he's so focused on this.
Well, it's also about guilt and loss and so many other emotions that this main character is going through.
Before the Black Mirror type element sort of becomes, shows up in the final few minutes, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first episode could almost be a drama.
Yeah, sure.
Just a straight drama.
Yeah. Nick, I don't want to talk about it on mic because I don't want to spoil anything, but I have a theory as to what's going on that you may know more about when we get to the second and third episodes.
Yes.
Because I have a theory about where it's going. But I do think there might be a conspiracy element to it.
Do we want to say what happens at the end of the first episode?
No.
It's kind of the premise of the series.
No, I don't think we should. I think
I think people should just sort of sit down and listen to.
Okay.
It's really...
I think by saying Black Mirror...
kind of gives a good...
We'll give you a sense of kind of what they do with it.
I do want to go on record as saying I like this more than The Message.
Me too. So far, I like it better.
I think
so far, I like it less.
Production values are so good in this.
Yes.
Yeah.
We were talking about it with... our former staffer, Amanda?
Yeah.
On Sunday... And she was saying, when they're out at a bar in it or whatever, and you can hear the background noise.
It doesn't feel canned or anything.
No, it's very convincing.
Yeah.
When he's in the office, you feel like you're in the office with him.
And the voice acting, none of them I feel like are major players or anything, but
right.
they're very compelling in what they do, and I don't know. I've been engaged, completely engaged with the story.
Yeah, it's definitely high on my listening list right now. What about Nick? There was one more you were going to mention.
Oh yeah, there was one more,
and then I'm going to stealth in one at the very end.
Oh, I see.
Ooh, yeah, stealth. That's right. That's
stealth
right.
Podcast.
You weren't ready for it. It's not even in your notes.
No, this one is from Spoke Media and Wondery. It is a podcast called Terms, which I'll just give the brief synopsis because I have it here. It says, on election night, two-term President Oliver Pierce watches in disbelief from the White House as Charles Dunwalk wins a controversial electoral college victory. With only 73 days before Dunwalk's inauguration, President Pierce makes a secret decision to act with historic and possibly catastrophic consequences. So
I don't see how that could happen.
I don't see that could be relevant to anything.
No, it's not relevant. But this actually, they did do this before. I mean, all the stuff with Trump happened.
But it was in development within last year.
It was probably in development with the last
probably
year.
Probably one of those ones where they're like, what if he actually won and we had a nightmare apocalyptic scenario? It'll never happen, but wouldn't it make a good podcast?
Yeah.
Again, I think the production value on this is strong. I feel like some of the music is a little heavy-handed at times, but the sort of the way they portrayed the characters, especially because it's a Republican president who's sort of the sitting president, and then this guy wins who is also a Republican. And it's an interesting way of looking at things, and
I wanted to listen to this show based on what you told me about it. It sounds really interesting.
Here's my most important question, Nick.
Uh-huh.
Is it super depressing? Because it seems like in our current world it would make me really depressed.
I don't feel like it's super depressing because in a weird way this person is trying to act.
Okay.
Where, you know, and it feels like he may accomplish something.
Okay.
I feel like that's a major importance. And it's an interesting way because they do say he doesn't want to kill anybody. He basically wants to act within the guidelines of, you know, what he's able to act within law. And it's interesting. I feel like
the more West Wing than Scandal.
Yeah, it's more. Yes, that is a good comparison. It's more West Wing than Scandal. There's a third one that just hit yesterday, I think, and I need to listen to it on my way home. So I'm really excited by all these podcasts popping up.
Yep.
Dave, what
we need to do is have big, long, 50-hour drives so that we can listen to all of them.
I like that all the podcasts that I've been listening to have been like 15 to 20 minutes. It's a good sort of... I mean, I just moved out
to... You do a very polished burst of...
I moved out to Leander, so I have like a 20 or 30-minute drive from work to there.
Just enough time for an episode.
Just enough time for an episode.
It's kind of like those shorter episodes of things like that in these fiction podcasts. It's kind of like how TV has moved to somewhat shorter seasons that some of the best TV has. And then you get less, filler.
Yeah.
What is your stealth podcast?
My stealth podcast, and y'all tell me if I've actually mentioned this before, because for all I know, I did previously. My friend Mandy put me onto that. I've actually only checked this one episode. I'm really only recommending one episode or two episodes of this podcast, the No Sleep podcast. It's a horror podcast that's been around for several years. I think like since maybe 2010 or 2011.
Is this coming out of Message Board?
This particular episode is, but not all of them.
Okay,
are.
Not all of them.
Each
okay.
episode has like two or three red horror fiction fictions. In this particular case, it's an early one called Pen Pals or Pen Pal, and because most of them are just numbered like number six, number seven, et cetera. I'm gonna just quick tell y'all what this Pen Pal one debuted on October 26, 2011. And then there's a second part that was on December 17th, 2011. And I'm going to recommend just these two episodes on their own. I listened to them thinking I had tried this podcast and hadn't quite gotten to it. But I listened to these two, and they were great. They were very unnerving and creepy. And it's actually an adaptation or just a reading of some posts from a Redditor, actually, who himself introduces them. But it kind of has that feel of this really happened. Like he's like they're reading stories that are reminiscences about him when he was a kid, and they jump around in time and they have a strong feeling of reality. It's weird. It's almost this like Stand By Me-ish kind of thing, but about unnerving incidents that happened to him when he was a kid and how they all began to coalesce together. By the end of the second episode, each episode does have three different stories from him. And by the end of the second episode, it comes to its conclusion. And I will say it was so dark, it was almost too dark for me in its conclusion. But I was utterly entranced throughout. In one of the early ones, for instance, he talks about a project he did in school where he and all the other kids write their name and the school's address or something on a piece of paper, and they send them off in balloons. And they basically invite whoever finds that balloon to respond back and, tell them a little bit about themselves and maybe take up a little pen pal correspondence. That's where the title comes from. And then the teacher marks on a board on a map where they've all come from. And, it's an ongoing thing throughout the year that they revisit as they get letters from people.
Right.
Well, he finally gets one, and his has this kind of very weird note on it. And a sort of blurry photograph that he can't tell what it is. And, every time he gets one of these, he continues to get them over time. And they don't, I think it's later on that he realizes that he is in some of these photographs. Hmm. It's as if the person is around and watching. And, There's sort of hints of supernatural things, but it kind of sort of backs away and towards the possibility of supernatural stuff throughout. At first I didn't completely warm to it initially. I thought the narrator, who's not the Redditor guy, but is a separate narrator, I wasn't wholly convinced by his readings. But by the end, I thought he was doing a really good job. And if you want a sort of creepy, unnerving horror story that's sort of built around kids, this is your one. Check these two episodes out. The writing is, I think, exceptional. The ideas, will make you think of Stephen King and other really strong horror writers. And it definitely got under my skin as very few podcasts ever have. So okay. The episode Pen Pals 1 and 2.
All right. All right, that about wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and until that time,
Yo-jo.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.